Ladies and gentlemen, my name is
Scott.
Hey, yo.
Is that his younger brother? It's gonna be
Jeff.
The cream will rise to the top. Oh, yeah.
And you're listening to
all of the great action figures from our good friends at Hasbro.
The Fully Posable.
Have your own WrestleMania with all your favorite figures.
Wrestling figure.
He sold separately from LJN.
Podcast.
And we are the Mount Rushmore of professional wrestling.
Hey, welcome to Fully Posable's podcast special interview. My name is Jeff Singh. Alongside next to me is my real life brother and our storyline brother, Scott. Scott, say hello.
Hello.
And on the line, Scott, we have from Pro Wrestling Torch Collectibles column, Michael Moore. How you doing, Michael?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Absolutely.
It's our pleasure. Michael, I was reading over your bio and I noticed that you had sent in a script to WWE. What was that like and what was the outcome?
Well, the outcome wasn't good, but no. So I grew up a wrestling fan like you guys, and I've been a writer since ever I can remember. My first job was actually with a newspaper when I was 15, but I was working for a newspaper down in the Houston area in 2001. It was actually right before WrestleMania 17, which was down there in the Astrodome, and had always wanted to work for the WWF or Pro Wrestling Illustrated. Those were my two big goals or dreams as a kid, and was kind of browsing their website, and I saw that they had a position open for a producer's assistant or whatever they call that, but I didn't know the difference, and I just had I had actually done some interviews with some talent and had gone to the WrestleMania 17 press conference, so I kind of felt like I had a couple of ins with them, and applied for the job. I didn't hear anything back, and just by chance happened to take a random guess at what Stephanie McMahon's corporate email was at that time and send it off. And the next day I get a call at work from Jennifer Hume, who was her assistant, I guess, at that time, who was actually the woman in the DDP the positivity skits they did.
Yeah.
So she calls me and says, you know, you applied for this job. We think you'd actually be much better as a writer. So what I want you to do is I want you to write a script. And she kind of gave me the guidelines and sent me a packet and all this. And so I was just on cloud nine at that point. And this was right before WrestleMania, like I said. And so I can't remember the timeline of when the purchase of WCW came out, because this was all within the same week. And so I think this was before, but I might be after. So I wrote this storyline about, it's been a long time. The WCW guys at the end of WrestleMania, when they're in this big main event with Rock and Austin, and the WCW guys coming in and basically crashing WrestleMania. And of course, when I'm writing this, I'm thinking Goldberg and Kevin Nash and not Sean O'Hare and Chuck Palumbo, you know, and the guys who actually, So I wrote this storyline, and I honestly don't remember a lot of the details of it, but I was feeling pretty good. I thought it was good. And some time goes by, and Jennifer Hume calls me and says, you know, hey, you know, we're still looking over it. We'll let you know. Just wanted to touch base. So I'm still thinking things are pretty good. And then a couple weeks later, get this packet back in the mail with a copy of my script that I had sent them, just saying they're not going to offer me the job. And there's all these comments written all over the script at that point saying, repeatedly, too much wrestling, too much wrestling, too much wrestling. And you know, so I was really bummed at the time, but you know, I got a rejection letter with Stephanie McMahon's autograph on it, so I still have that.
Well, Michael, what were you thinking putting wrestling into a wrestling script? Jeez.
and this was right about the time I think that she had taken over creative, and there was that push to bring in the quote unquote Hollywood writers, you know. And so I, you know, being a 24-year-old newspaper writer, I don't know, you know, why they were interested in me to begin with, but you know, it was a real bummer. But you know, I know realistically now, from having talked to some former creative guys and listened to some of their interviews and things, that there's no way I would have ever lasted in that environment.
See, where you were thinking Sting and Goldberg, you had to think more Glacier and Canyon.
Yeah, I shot too high, and you know, I should have been thinking about you know, Ernest Miller coming in, maybe.
You wanted what the rest of us wanted, but what we actually got was, ugh, not great.
Disaster. Yeah, it was a disaster. But
Michael, what is your first memory of wrestling figures or wrestling?
It's kind of funny. They kind of tie in together. I mean, I guess I kind of, you know, I had watched the Rock and Wrestling cartoon, and a little bit of World Class on TV and some things like that, and knew a little bit about it, but I didn't really follow it. And for my 10th birthday, I have a brother who's 15 years older than me, and I'd gotten some comp tickets to a WWF show in Denver. And so my parents were telling me that day, hey, your brother's going to take you somewhere for your birthday tonight. And I didn't know anything about it. And coincidentally, I had to go to my dad was retired Air Force, and I went and got an ID card at the Air Force base. And we stopped by the PX, and I walked in, and there's the LJN series hanging on the pegs. And didn't really know, you know, like I said, I kind of peripherally knew about wrestling, but not really. And I just remember just mesmerized by those things for some reason. You know, I was a lot like you guys. I grew up in the 80s and played with Star Wars and He-Man and G.I. Joe and, you know, whatever the toys were back then. And but there's Hulk Hogan and the Iron Sheik and Hillbilly Jim, and I just thought these things were really cool. And I remember picking up the Hogan figure and asking my dad if I could get it. And he said, you don't even know anything about wrestling. And I said, well, these are, you know, these are neat. So he bought me the Hogan figure. I don't really know anything about wrestling. And then I get home, my brother comes over and says, hey, we're going to go see wrestling tonight in Denver. Well, that's pretty good coincidence there with the figure. But the reason that he did it was because a few years earlier, I had been an A-Team fan and had some Mr. T posters hanging on my wall, and that old Mr. T doll. I don't know if you guys remember that.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we had it too.
Oh, yeah, sure did.
The little earrings that plugged into the ears. But yeah. The reason he was taking me was Mr. T was actually going to be in Hulk Hogan's corner that night in Denver. So he's taking me to see Mr. T. And we get there, and it's pretty packed. It was at the old McNichols Arena. It was pretty packed. On the first couple of matches were what you got. I think we got Haku against it was funny, some local jobber guy that my brother had actually gone to college with. And the guy tripped a couple minutes into the match and hit his head on the turnbuckle and busted himself open.
Oh, he got color in an opener. Wow.
Yeah, that was my first experience. I don't remember the guy's name or anything, but yeah, that was my first experience. I'm like, oh, this guy's bleeding all over the place. What's going on? But there was a couple of, you know, pretty boring matches. And then we got a match between Don Morocco and Ricky Steamboat. And I was just drawn in at that point. I mean, Steamboat was so good. I mean, just everything he did. And Morocco was just this awful big bad guy beating him up throughout the match. But that was really exciting. The main event for that was actually Hulk Hogan and Terry Funk. And Hogan beat him. I don't remember much about it. I actually don't remember much past the Steamboat and Morocco match other than just being completely enthralled with that match.
So that's what hooked you, was Steamboat?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And so seeing Steamboat and then, like, the next week, turning on, you know, my parents had one of those old little TVs in the kitchen, and turned that on, watch cartoons, and it happened to be Superstars of Wrestling, and so there was a Steamboat match on there, and I thought, you know, I was like, oh, that's the guy that I saw in Denver last week, and so watched that, and just got drawn in, and from that point, I started looking for everything I could find, and that, you know, back then, we still had the NWA show at 6:05 on Saturdays, and we had the AWA on ESPN and World Class on ESPN. So there was a lot of cool stuff. And it went to every video store I could find and rented every wrestling tape I could find.
Now, did you collect the LJNs too?
I wouldn't say I collected. I mean, kind of with all my friends, you know, played with them and beat the hell out of them and don't have many that have much paint left on them anymore. But I had all of them up through about the first three series or so. And then when the black cards hit, in the back of the Pro Wrestling Illustrateds, and that one, they were, you know, at the time considered expensive, which I wish I could go back and buy them all for the $11.99 or whatever they were asking for.
We'll gladly pay that now, yes.
And was also, at that point, I was 13 or 14 and was just kind of, you know, just moving away from wrestling toys. But I had all of them for a long time, and then my mom gave them all to my nephews, and they're gone. I don't know where they are. But I still have a handful of them, but I've still got my Bundy and the Hogan and a couple other ones, and then a couple other ones that I have picked up, you know, through the years since then. But
recreating WrestleMania too, huh?
Yeah, yeah. Breaking it more times than my parents had, taken it back to the store and buying me another one and buying me another one before they just gave up on it.
Oh, gosh.
So you went away from toys. What brought you back into it? What figure brought you back into it?
You know, what actually brought me back was the night before my high school graduation. I was out with a couple friends, and we were at the mall, and there was a toy show going on, and this was 94. Actually, let me scratch that and go back. So I was at, this was a couple months before that, actually. I'm at the mall and we're just walking around and happened to walk in KB Toys and didn't really know. I had my nephews that I mentioned before. My youngest one, Alex, had played with the Hasbros by that point. This is early 90s. And so I was familiar with him. I had seen his Andre and his Demolition and Hogan and, the first series of him. Mm-hmm. This was 94, and I remember going into a toy store and I saw the Red Card figures hanging up there, and saw the Bret Hart figure hanging in front, and I was just a huge Bret Hart fan growing up, always mm-hmm. was. So I saw that and I just thought, well, this is really, I had remembered kind of seeing the first one with the silver shade or with the pink shades.
Uh-huh.
Just kind of wasn't overwhelmed by that. I mean, I wasn't buying toys at the time,
mm-hmm.
but I saw the Red Card one, and there was just something about it with the way that the different color scheme with the pink top and the black tights and the skin color looked better. I was just like, oh, I got to have this. And so I picked it up and took it home and put it on the computer desk at my house. And I thought, well, that's pretty neat. I think I'll go back and buy the rest of them, which was, the Undertaker with the cloak and the Yokozuna.
Yeah, Yoko and Luger were in that set.
Yep.
But by the time I went back, they were gone. So I just kind of thought, oh, well, whatever. And then a couple months later, my friend and I were, that summer, were out the toy stores, and we saw those. I think they were the dark blue cards that had the repaints on the Shawn and the Razor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I picked some of those up and then just really started picking the LJNs up from there. And a good friend of mine that I'd grown up with, who I'm still friends with to this day, was getting back into it too. And so we started going to every thrift store and every garage sale and everything we could find, trying to find old wrestling toys. And this was like 94, 95, and didn't have a lot of luck, but we did find one store that was selling a bunch of old LJNs that I had never actually seen as a kid, like Axe and Billy Jack Haynes and a couple of those. So I picked those up for Kamala, picked those up for a couple of bucks each. And
that's awesome. So have you gone back since to try to complete your Hasbros?
No, I've been real selective on just who I've bought. I mean, I've gone back over the years and bought everyone I've wanted other than that Undertaker with the cloak. I've always wanted that thing.
That was the mail away?
No, there was two mail-aways. There was the one in the red card. There was two of that Undertaker with the cloak, the Red Card one, and then the mail-away one. And I guess the hair color was different.
Oh, right. Yes, that's right.
Yeah, and so the Red Card one was the one I always wanted. But the thing is still, I mean, it's not cheap to pick up on eBay.
I think that's when they started to dry up a little bit, was the Red Card series. You weren't finding them. They weren't as plentiful as they used to be.
You know, what's funny is, like, a year later, summer of 95, KB started getting all of those French cards. Have you seen those?
Yes.
Yeah, KB had gotten a ton of those, and they got a whole bunch of the Red Cards in, but no Bret and no Undertaker for whatever reason. Hmm. So I remember I picked up Bam Bam and Yokozuna and Luger and all those guys, but never again saw another Bret or Undertaker. But I've gone back and bought the ones I wanted, Undertaker and Kerry Von Erich and both the Brets and a bunch of the other ones like that. There's a few that I want that I've never gotten. I always wanted the 1-2-3 Kid. Never saw those, the green cards in person. Never saw those in the stores.
They were impossible to find.
Yeah, and even I remember going to the first toy show I ever went to was like in 95, late 95, and saw those for the first time. And even then they were, the guy was wanting $100 a piece for them or something like that. And jeez. I've never gone back and splurged on any of those since. But the Kid was one I always wanted. I thought the Atom Bomb was pretty cool.
Yeah, we really lucked out. We've talked about it on the podcast that we actually had a connection in Castro Valley. This guy that owned a little toy shop, he was carrying, I think, the first two series of Hasbros. And when I started having trouble finding them at retail, he ended up, I just talked to him just kind of out of the blue, like, hey, you used to carry the Hasbros. Are you going to carry those again? And he goes, well, they weren't selling too well. He goes, but if you want them, I can order a case of them. And I was like, yeah, I'll tell you what, if you order a case, I'll buy at least one of each out of the case, and then you could just sell off the remainders. He's like, yeah, that's fine. So starting basically from like the Red Card on, he was our Hasbro guy. So oh, without wow. him, yeah, we wouldn't have found any of them, because I think our Toys R Us started stopping carrying Hasbros right around the Anvil, Neidhart, Virgil, Warlord series.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
They really started to dry up at our Toys R Us. Now, we're on the West Coast. I know the East Coast is a little bit different. Midwest, too. But without that Castro Valley guy, we would have been paying, like you mentioned, $100 per green card.
Oh yeah, that's awesome that you were able to get those. That's really cool.
We lucked out big time.
Yeah, we got really lucky with that guy. And it's just Scott making connections too.
Yeah, that's
one thing when I was reading over your bio that I thought was really cool, because Scott and I used to collect these all the time, and then I saw that you worked for him. You worked for Beckett.
I didn't work for them, but I was a freelance writer for them for about 7 years. Yeah, from about 2001 to 2007.
How did that come about?
I had interviewed, again, I was living in Texas at the time, and had, this was about a year, no, actually this was just a couple months after the whole WWF thing, and they had a job for a card grader at the time, which was, I think it was like a minimum wage job too, it wasn't anything big, but I'd applied for that, and they called me back and they said, you know, you're too experienced for this, but we would be interested if you want to do some freelance writing for us. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I wanted to do anyway, really, you know. So, got in touch with the editor of the football publication, because I've really been a football card collector most of my life. And so I wrote an article for her. She was pretty happy with it. She sent me on to, they used to have, it was a really short-lived, I think it was called Beckett Sports Collectibles.
Mm-hmm.
And it was when the bobblehead craze was really big. And so it was kind of like a guide to bobbleheads and sports figures, like the old starting lineups and things like that. So I wrote an article for them. And did a couple for them, but I mostly wrote for the football one. And they gave me a column where I was supposed to write about rising stars in football and which cards to collect. Had that for about a year. They just kind of decided to move on from that. And so I did a lot of feature columns. I did one that was really funny. 2005, the Texans drafted a guy by the name of Vernon Morency, the running back. And the editor of the magazine was at the what's called the NFL Rookie Premiere, which after they draft all of the rookies, they get them all together in California, and they sign cards, and they do their take pictures for the cards, and they get their jerseys and all that kind of stuff. And he's watching the whole thing, and he's watching Vernon Morency sign, and the guy's just writing a check mark on all the cards. So he thought maybe this guy is just testing the pens or whatever. No, that was this guy's autograph. I mean, you can Google it, look it up. His name's Vernon Morency, and his autograph was a ear, a check mark. That was it. So.
Oh, wow.
They asked me to write this article about football players and it was, you know, athletes in particular, with focus on football, about guys just completely giving up on their autographs and these really lazy autographs. And they did this really cool sidebar they put together where they each had like their 3-year-old kids sign their names and compare them like side by side with these athletes like Michael Vick and everything who, you know, were writing slop. But it's funny. I was by that point I was living back in Wyoming, which is where I live now, and was working. I was the editor of a weekly paper here, and I didn't have a cell phone at that point. And I came home and had made some calls about guys with bad autographs and had let some people know, hey, I'm working on this story, just trying to get some input. And I come home and I've got just, my voicemail is just full of all these calls. And I'm like, what is this? And it was the NFL Players Association was freaked out and was calling my house trying to figure out, what am I writing? What is my goal with this? Just, you know, they're very protective of their properties, but they were just really, it was really funny. You know, just some guy in Casper, Wyoming, and there's the NFL Players Association calling me, freaking out because I'm working on this story about guys with sloppy autographs and things like that.
Jeez, how dare you have an opinion?
Right. And, you know, that was before Dean Ambrose, and we saw the crap that he signs too. So
thank you. Yeah, it's horrible.
Oh, yeah.
It's all.
Scott and I experienced that in Reno.
Yeah, worst $40 I've ever spent on an autograph.
So you went from there onto a newspaper. From there, then after that, you went to Pro Wrestling Torch. And
well, I've actually worked. I worked for a newspaper from, let's say I worked for a couple in Texas from about 99 to about 2003. By that point, my wife and I had two kids and we're looking to get closer back to home. My family's was in Colorado where I grew up, and hers is here in Wyoming. And, so I got offered a job with the weekly paper here at the time. And so I was actually working the newspaper business for about 10 years and was always kind of writing on the side for Beckett. And I wrote for Beckett, like I said, for about 7 years. I wrote for Pro Wrestling Illustrated for a couple of years. Wrote for, I always just wanted to kind of have a creative outlet. And so in about 2010, I wrote for Tough Stuff, which was kind of the lower end Beckett. But gave me a lot of freedom to write some columns, and then they went out of business. And so that 2011, I'd always been a Torch reader and saw Wade Keller had sent out a request for new writers and just kind of pitched the idea to him for a collectibles column, because I always just been a fan of cards and figures and just kind of following secondary market activity and things like that as it is. And so pitched the idea with him. He liked it. And that was like I said, January 2011, and I've been doing it ever since. Just one or two columns a week, and get a lot of freedom from him, and you know, gives me some good ideas and some good advice sometimes, and it's just been really cool.
So you've been doing it for coming up on 6 years. What
6 years?
What rare collectibles have you seen? Like, what is something that made you go, whoa, wait a second?
So there's a guy by the name of Jerry, and he very well will be listening to this. I'm going to butcher his last name, Sourbeer, I think. yeah. Hey, Jerry. I'll make sure I mention this to him. He contacted me within the first year or two I was there wanting to get my opinion on something. And so I was like, you know, this is cool. What you got? And he's a big, big, big wrestling collector. He lives in the Midwest, I think in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And he's got a group of buddies that's called the Front Row Mafia. And but he has, I guess WWE sold these, one of the turnbuckles from WrestleMania 20 that is signed by Chris Benoit and inscribed 2004 world champion or something like that.
Wow.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's kind of the centerpiece of his collection. He's kind of gone through different points, I think, of you know, kind of displaying it and taking it down and putting it back out and taking it down again. But you know, that was one of the really probably the coolest thing I've ever seen through this. Just, and it was really funny because it generated a lot of, as you would expect, a lot of discussion among readers. Just some people saying, "Wow, that's really cool." Some people saying, "Why would you even want that at this point?"
Mm-hmm.
You know, just value wise, you know, that was one of the things he wanted to know. And I don't remember what he said he paid for it, but it was ridiculously low. But, you know, people were asking, you know, what do you think that's worth? And it's really, how do you put a price on something?
That was my question. How do you even put a value on top of that?
Because you may find somebody. I remember right after the Benoit news broke, it's kind of a morbid thing. And this is not unique to wrestling. This is all sports. But whenever somebody dies, there's immediately an increase in interest in their autographs because they're not around anymore and they can't sign. Right. But what you always get invariably is their autographs just pop up on eBay at that point, you know, with jacked up prices. But I remember watching the Benoit activity when the news came out that he had died. And I remember seeing a couple of his, he's got a couple of autographs from Tops from around 2005 or six. And I remember seeing those things jump up and selling for 150 or 200 bucks within hours. A couple hours later, the news comes out about what really happened. And I mean, literally within hours, this thing goes from about 20, 30 bucks to a couple hundred bucks back down to selling for like $8. And, you know, it's kind of been that, you know, it's kind of that way since for a long time. It's just, you have people that think I wouldn't spend a dollar on that. And then you have people that think, you know, well, I'll give you $100 for that or, you know, whatever. It's really, really unique situation. I can't think of anybody else like that.
Now, you were telling me one time, and we'll backtrack a little bit, you said it around WrestleMania 17. Didn't you interview Chris during that, around that time?
I did. Yeah, it was actually the fall prior to that. WWE was doing a Raw from Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that fall, and it was around the same time they were doing the press conference. And so I was getting media credentials to cover the press conference, which was a really cool experience, and also trying to get an interview set up for our, we had a weekend publication called The Ticket, which would focus on concerts or events or whatever that were coming to town, and that was coming up. So I did a big feature article on that, and they called me back and they said, well, who do you want to interview? And you know, I'm thinking, we're not a big, you know, we're not the Houston Chronicle or anything. They're going to give me Midian or somebody like this to interview. And I said, and so I just was kind of really, you know, gracious and just said, well, whoever you guys, you know, whoever's available, I'll be glad to talk to him. And they said, well, what about Kurt Angle? And this is right after Kurt had won the title for the first time.
Whoa.
Yeah. That would be, that'd be great. I wasn't expecting that at all.
Best case scenario. So,
yeah. So I get this interview set up with Kurt Angle, and they call me back and they say, well, Kurt's actually tied up with another interview. He can't do it. Would you be interested in interviewing Raven? And this was, you know, Raven had just come in after leaving WCW or leaving, you know, WCW, going to ECW for a year.
Uh-huh.
And then, and I thought, wow, Raven would be, it would seem odd to me because Raven was just back there. You know, he hadn't been there very long, but I thought, well, yeah, Raven would be an awesome interview. So then they call back and they say, Raven's actually tied up too, but we can get Chris Benoit on the phone with you. Well, cool. You know, like a lot of the guys our age and who have interest like we do, was a big one Benoit fan, and I thought, well, that would be really cool. And so I set that up, and he, you know, I put a bunch of time into prepping for the interview and everything, and get him on the phone, and I have only ever had a couple of interviews go as badly as that one did. He did not, and I don't know. I've talked to a lot of people who have said what a gracious guy he was. Hey, he was really, you know, really nice guy, but he could not have been more difficult to interview. He didn't want to answer anything I asked him. He was very short with me. He didn't want to give, and he was like really insulted with a lot of the questions that I was asking him. And just, I remember hanging up the phone and going, well, that didn't go well. And, you know, I was able to put enough of an interview together, but yeah, it was awful. I mean, it was just not a good interview.
Out of curiosity, do you happen to remember any of the questions that he kind of avoided or stayed away from, or he didn't answer thoroughly?
Well, there was a couple of them. I remember, you know, this was 6 months or so after him jumping from WCW with the Radicals. Uh-huh. And I remember I had read some other interviews where he had talked about how WWF was the most professionally run company he had ever worked for. So I kind of tried to lead him in that direction and said, you know, what's it been like working for the WWF? And he gave me the exact same answer. It's the most professionally run company I've ever worked for, hands down. And I just kind of waited for him to expand on that, and I didn't get anything. And I said, so I kind of asked him some other questions to try and prompt him, and he just kept saying that. It's the most professionally run company I've ever worked for, hands down. So I brought up, I was trying to get him to talk about something. And so I brought up some of his work in New Japan with Kensuke Sasaki and some people. And I asked him, I said, you know, how do you compare the experiences of working for New Japan Pro Wrestling to the WWF? And he just like, I mean, it was like I insulted his mother at that point. And it was just like, well, you can't compare the two things. They're different things. And I said, well, yeah, that's kind of what I'm asking you. And he said, well, if I go out there and I wrestle The Rock, and then the next night I go out there and wrestle Kensuke Sasaki, it's not the same thing. I can't compare the two. And he was just really belligerent about the whole thing. And there was just a lot of that. And there was a couple times where I'd ask him a question and he'd kind of sigh and just like I was wasting his time with it. And I tried not to be a mark during the whole thing, but I tried not to be, you know, you've got to kind of have an idea of who you're interviewing and try to be, you know, professional about it. And it just didn't go well.
Since you've been working for the Torch, do people send you collectibles or send you anything?
I get a lot of questions. Uh-huh. And some of them are really cool. Most people that take the time to send me an email or a tweet or whatever are really cool. You know, they'll say, hey, have you ever seen this before? I've had people, you know, ask me about old videotapes, because there is quite a market for old, especially 80s and 90s. Well, I guess that would be pretty much the market of WWF and WCW tapes. Mm-hmm. I've had people send me saying, I have this, you know, one of the really common ones is I have a figure of, I don't know, Steve Austin, and it's on a package with Kurt Angle in the back. Is this rare? Is this worth anything?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just kind of stuff happens a lot. But, you know, people sending me pictures of old cards or nothing I can't think of that really stumped me. One of the things that's really cool, and I wrote this, I think this was back in 2011, I had a guy contact me and he said, I just thought I'd share this story with you. And he was at some sort of media thing. I don't know if it was like the thing in Las Vegas. I can't remember, but there were a bunch of different celebrities from different walks of life there.
Uh-huh.
And Hogan was there signing autographs, and this was when he was with TNA.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy had heard that Hogan was going to be there, and so he brought an old trading card of Hogan's to have him sign it, and brought it up to him, and Hogan just blew him off and was really nasty to him. And the Miz was actually there too, and Miz saw the whole thing happen and walked up to the guy and said, what happened? And he said, I asked him to sign it, and he said, no, I'm not going to sign that. And Miz, I guess, got really angry and said, what do you mean he's not going to sign it? He said, I don't know. That's just what he told me. And so he's got this card that Miz signed. It's a card of Hogan that the Miz signed and wrote, always support fans, and wrote, you know, signed it the Miz on there. So I thought that was really cool. It's really different seeing something like that.
Wow.
That's actually really cool of Miz.
I know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I met Miz one time back, I believe it was in 2011. And he couldn't have appeared to be less interested in meeting me than, I don't know, it was just a weird experience. So to hear that he like jumped to a fan's defense, that's actually really cool.
Yeah, yeah. That's weird that you get to, that, you know, it kind of goes back to the thing about Benoit that I was sending. I was really ticked about it at the time. But, you know, you kind of think, you know, you don't know how you're catching these guys. You know, you don't know what kind of day they're having or what's going on. So try not to be too judgmental about him or anything, because you just don't know what you're getting on that day.
Do you happen to have any rare figures or any rare, I know you're also into cards, any rare cards or anything that you've gotten from professional wrestling?
Well, I've gotten into I started collecting cards with you guys have probably remember them, the 85 or 86 Topps WWF cards.
Yep,
sure do.
Yeah, started with that. That was kind of what drew me in, and I've collected over the years. The last couple years, I've really gotten into Japanese wrestling, And so I've got a lot of autographs from New Japan. I've got a lot of guys like Tanahashi and Okada, Tomoaki Onma, and some guys like that. Really rare things. Figure-wise, I've kind of always... I have three kids, and they really collect. And so, you know, kind of limited on what you can collect at that point when you're buying stuff for your kids, too. But I've always tried to kind of get, at least, like I mentioned, I'm a big Bret Hart fan. And tried to get, you know, at least one of his figures from each line. And so I've got the original LJN one, which a guy in Canada got for me several years ago, which was really cool. When the, you know, some different ones like that. I've got it's not a valuable item or anything, but I've got are you guys familiar with French Angel, Maurice Tillet?
No.
He was a guy who wrestled in 30s, 40s, something like that, who kind of had gigantism. There's always been this speculation of he was the model for Shrek, or no, yes, he wasn't, and no, he wasn't, and all this. But I guess, Bruce Pritchard has talked on his podcast about having the bronze death mask from when the guy passed away. But I've got some cards that I bought a few years ago from 1948 of Maurice Tillet that are these little tiny, they're about the eighth of a normal trading card.
Whoa.
So that's kind of cool. And one of the things I've kind of tried to do over the years is when I get a chance, my dad used to take me to a lot of house shows, and when WWF would come through Colorado in the 80s and early 90s. And so I've got just a ton of pictures that he took. And so when I've gotten the chance, I've tried to get some of those pictures signed by some of the wrestlers. And I met Ted DiBiase about a year and a half ago, and had a really cool picture from a match he had with Jake Roberts, and brought a bunch of them. And, you know, I said, would you mind signing this? This was a picture my dad took of you in 89 or something like that. It was really cool because DiBiase he looked like he was really touched by it. And he said, you know, can I take a look at those? So I handed him the stack of pictures, and it was just like, it was really cool just looking at him flipping through those with a smile on his face. And so he signed one of those for me, and I've got that framed and hung up and some different things like that.
Oh, nice.
That's great. Yeah, every time I've met DiBiase, he's been very, very cool. Definitely takes his time with the fans. You mentioned you have boys. Are they interested in wrestling, or are they collecting wrestling figures at all?
Yeah, they are. I have three sons, and they are 11. My middle one is about to turn 13. And they're about to turn 14, sorry. And my oldest is turned 16 in December. And they're all real interested. My oldest one is, it's kind of funny because he started playing with wrestling toys, you know, early 2000s when he was little. And they're, you know, the Jax toys. And he still to this day is a bit of a Jax snob. He doesn't like he doesn't like the Mattel figures very much. He'll get on eBay and look for Jax figures and things. I mean, he will find some of his favorites. He's a big CM Punk fan. Mm-hmm. And, so he'll get a couple of those and hang those up on his wall. He's got a Miz figure hanging on his wall. And then the other two are still, you know, they keep talking about February 12th. And I keep saying, what is February 12th? Not the older one, but the two younger ones. And they're saying, well, that's our big pay-per-view. We're having a whole bunch of them. So they've got this whole pay-per-view planned with their wrestling figures for February 12th.
So that's awesome.
we've got a gigantic tub of figures that they have. And then the other ones they've collected and they've kept in the boxes and put aside. And my oldest son, really quick story, this is funny, but he's a big John Cena fan. And he went through the period of, he was little, he liked John Cena. And he's very smart in the way that he'll watch wrestling and you know, he'll ask a lot of questions. And he actually on his own kind of went out and did some writing for a wrestling website when he was 14 or 15. But I remember when we were watching the SummerSlam where they had the Nexus against the WWE guys. Uh-huh. And we're watching that, and he was at that point where he kind of liked John Cena, but it was kind of cool to boo John Cena. And but we're watching this, and you know, the WWE guys go on to win. And John Cena's celebrating. And I just remember he got this really disappointed look on his face. And he looked at me and he goes, why does John Cena always have to win?
LOL.
I thought that was funny. It was a 9-year-old kid asking me that at that point. It was kind of what everybody was asking at that time. So I thought that was pretty funny.
That's hilarious.
Super Cena.
Yeah, no doubt.
But that's funny because that's what we went through with Hogan back in the 80s.
Oh, yeah. And I don't know about you guys, but I was immediately turned off, even as a kid, by Hogan. I mean, you know, my parents took me to see him, and I thought it was, you know, I thought he was cool. He was the superhero and everything, but it really didn't take long for me to realize that, man, I don't like this guy. And still, one of the most memorable things in wrestling to me to this day is the Paul Orndorff turning on Hogan. you know, and it was so well done.
Ditto.
And,
yep.
And just at first I was really angry, but then I was like, you know, because, you know, I mean, I was a kid and you know, you cheered for Luke Skywalker and you cheered for He-Man and oh no, Paul Orndorff turned bad. And thought about it and thought, wait a minute, I don't like Hulk Hogan, so this is actually kind of cool.
I'm cheering your Orndorff.
I've never been a Hogan fan. I mean, it's just from immediately he rubbed me the wrong way, and I didn't like the storytelling of him. You know, to this day, I have never seen the main event of WrestleMania 7 with him and Slaughter because I knew what it was going to be, you know, mm-hmm. and I remember watching the pay-per-view, and when that match came on, my friends and I turned it off, and it was so formulaic. I remember having a WrestleMania party with the year before when I was like in eighth grade with the Warrior match, and we were all cheering for the Warrior, and Hogan kicks out of the press slam and starts hulking up, and we're just like, we're screaming at the TV and plug the TV and everything, and one of my friends goes, no, wait. And from the corner of his eye, sees Hogan go for the leg drop and miss. And, you know, Warrior splashes him and pins him and just erupted. I mean, it was really cool.
So you must have hated WrestleMania 9 then.
Oh, God. I can't bring that up. I destroyed the coffee table in my house, actually.
Farley'd it. Awesome.
No, I picked up I had one of those popcorn tins of you know, you'd get those tins that were full of popcorn or whatever. My mom would always go to the store and buy me snacks. And so I had friends over and we were watching it. And I just was at this point where I was always thinking, you know, King Kong Bundy and Earthquake. And there's no way Yokozuna's going to win the title. There's no way. And he beats. And I'm just like, what the hell? You know, and a couple of my friends were making fun of me because they were wrestling fans, but they weren't as into wrestling as I was. And they certainly weren't the Bret fan that I was. And I'm just ticked. And then I see Hogan come down to the ring. And we're like, no, they're not going to do this. So the whole thing happens and my friends are just laughing and they're just shaking their heads, and I just remember I just picked up this popcorn tin and just chucked it at this coffee table that we had and just busted the coffee table down the middle. Yeah, I was not a fan of that event.
That sounds like me after a Demolition beat Strikeforce.
Yeah.
Or when Bad News Brown tossed Brett out of the four battle royal.
Yeah, that too. Michael, what do you think of the Figures Toy Company figures that are coming out?
I love them. They did just such a phenomenal job with them. I don't think I've seen one yet where you can look at the head sculpt and say, boy, that missed. You know, like there's, you guys joke a lot about the Becky Lynch Mattel figure and how bad that is.
Yes.
Every bit of everything you say about it, and you know, Mattel does that from time to time, but man, Figures really takes the time with the head sculpts on that. And I think more importantly than that is the way, I think you guys have talked about this too, the clothing and the you know, the tights and the trunks, obviously, but just they seem to hit perfectly with the accessories that they put with it. I mean, the vest with the AJ was really cool.
Yes, completely agree with you on that.
And I think, you know, I've been blown away since I saw the head sculpt of the Bobby Fish figure. I mean, that is just so cool looking.
It's amazing, yeah.
Everything they do, you know, there's some of the guys that they make that I don't really have a lot of interest in getting myself necessarily. Mm-hmm. But you can look at all of them, and they're just, everything they've done is just really fantastic, especially Bucks figures coming out, and you know, Kenny Omega is going to be beyond hot when that comes out, I think. And yeah, they just, and everything about them is really cool. The packaging is great, the figures are great, the accessories are really cool. I mean, it's just they've really done a great job with those.
Value wise, Michael, where do you see those falling? Because they are limited runs, from what Chris has said, 2,000 to 3,000 per figure. Mm-hmm. And if they jump ship, if WWE grabs them, you know, they're only getting to make one, really, like Chris Hero, for example, and Kevin Steen. Where do you see these going value-wise, say, the next 4, 5, 6 years?
It's so hard to say. You know, it's hard to tell what's going to get hot, because every now and then, you know, you can look at the stuff that Ringside Collectibles will sell, some of the Mattel exclusives they've done.
Right.
And some of those sit there for quite a while, and it doesn't seem like there's a lot of interest. And then a year later, they're selling for $100.
Yes.
You know? Timing really has worked out well for Figures Toy Company with AJ signing with WWE, because you know that just increased interest in that figure, which was already going to be a hot figure as it was.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I would imagine, I mean, you know, they have the $30 price point, which is a little tough. I mean, you know, and I completely understand it for what they're doing, the size of their company and everything. But, you know, for a lot of people, that's going to be a little tough. But it's so hard to say what's going to hold its value. But I think with those, you're getting a lot, most of the times, the first time figures of guys, in a lot of cases, you're getting the better looking figure of those guys. I really think, you know, it's certainly not something that's going to be OSFTM or Toy Biz that's going to be worthless, you know, down the road. But I think there's always going to be a market for those. I think there's, you know, they're so well done that I would imagine that they at least, at the very least, hold their value, if not go up.
Out of curiosity, what do your three boys think of the Figures Toy Company figures?
Oh, my oldest one loves them. Like I said, he's a bit of a Jax snob, and they've got that Jax feel to them for sure. Mm-hmm. But all three of them just love them. They've each got an AJ, and they love that figure. And looking forward to the Bucks and mm-hmm. the ones. I mean, it's so they love them. They're looking forward to more of them coming out.
A couple things we like to have our guests have is number one, a top five. What are your top five favorite figures of all time?
Wow.
These are never easy, Michael, ever.
I can say, you know, I had this discussion with Jeff a couple days ago, that Bret Hart Hasbro figure, the second one with the silver sunglasses, is my favorite for mm-hmm. sentimental reasons and just for liking the way that that figure looks. I just think that that's really cool. Mm-hmm. Hasbro-wise, that's got to be it. I'm looking at what I've got on my computer desk right now. That was it a Defining Moments, Bret, the one with the Calgary Stampede that Mattel did with the jacket?
Canadian flag, I believe it was.
Yep, that's really cool. I like that. I like the... I was always a big fan of Dr. Death and Terry Gordy. So I've got the Dr. Death Jax figure with the robe sitting on my desk. Not the BCA one that looked awful when he came in, but the, you know, the classic... Oh, God. But the classic Superstars one, I like that one a lot.
That's awesome.
That's a good figure.
Yeah, it's really cool. The Gordy I'm not so big on. It just doesn't look very good, but I always liked Gordy so much, so I got to have one of those. I like the Kerry Von Erich Mattel figure quite a bit.
Yes, that's an excellent figure.
Yeah.
And hard to find now, too.
Yeah, yeah. I was always a big fan of his as it was, and that figure's great. I've got that in the Kevin. Probably, you know, I don't know if it's maybe too early to say favorite, but the Magnum TA figure is just awesome. I mean, after so many years of finally getting one of those. And, yeah, I got into wrestling really Magnum's last year or so, and he was really cool. He was just such a great wrestler, and
yeah, it's sad. It makes you wonder what could have been with him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really think he would have been. You know, they wanted him to be their Hogan, I think, and not work one, but you know, star power wise, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, agree.
So I guess, you know, I'd probably say the two Bretts, the Magnum, the Kerry Von Erich, and the Dr. Death maybe would be. Yeah, I'd have to go back and look. I have, you know, some LJNs you got to throw in there, I think, and that'd probably be my top five.
Nice. Yeah, we, you and I were talking the other day, and I think I came to the realization that Bret with Silver Shades is definitely my favorite figure of all time.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's really cool.
It just captured Bret. Like, I hate to, sounds kind of weird, but he had like the perfect tan. The tights were perfect. The Silver Shades just
They really captured him well. I mean, for what, 4 inches of plastic? I mean, it was perfect.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I wanted to touch on with you guys real quick, and I'd asked Jeff about this because I wrote a column on this week for The Torch. I planned on a couple things, and I got some interviews backed up, so I put together a really quick column on the Galoob figures from WCW.
Yes.
And I don't own any of those, and I remember kind of when they first came out, but going back and looking at those again, it's really amazing how well done some of those were, and the faces on some of them for the time that they were in, and they really did a good job with those figures.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate that here in the US they only went one series, because the UK got like another one or two series after us. They got like the Freebirds, they got El Gigante, Big Josh, they got repaints of the first series. There was a Lex Luger in an entrance robe. We missed out on them here, and it really sucks because the Galoob Original 12 are some of my favorite figures ever. Like you said, the detail on them, just in little 4 inches of plastic, was just amazing. You couldn't move them, so they were much like LJNs. You were kind of stuck with what they gave you. But just the detail and the poses that they put them in, you could totally work around it, and it was fine. And man, just bad timing, bad luck. But I could have seen that in the U.S. here if they had done it right, going at least 4, 5, or 6 series.
Oh, yeah. And that, you know, that Gigante figure is really cool looking. And
it's excellent.
The Dustin Rhodes, too. Mm-hmm. Really cool. Figure. And when you look at, I was looking at some of the prototypes that are out there on some different sites. That PN News figure, I mean, it's PN News, but it's the detail on his face and everything is just incredible for something that was made, what, 26 years ago now in that line. I mean, it's really cool looking.
Yeah, it's amazing. That was supposed to be a Diamond Stud or Ricky Morton. Mm-hmm. and just what could have been. And we lament that quite often with the Galoob line. It's just they could have done so much more, but bad timing and bad luck, it just killed the line here in the U.S. But they were amazing figures. I mean, even Big Josh, you know, of all names. And then they did a fabulous Freebirds 2-pack that came with a sound module where it played their music. And those Freebirds figures are amazing. It just, unfortunately, the price tag prohibits me from completing the Galoob set, but one of these days, guaranteed, I'll be completing that set.
I was just looking those up on eBay the other day, and there's a Gigante up there right now that I think is at about $40 with a couple days left to go, and kind of keeping an eye on it, because I'd kind of like to have one of those. It's pretty cool looking.
You know, Michael, on Facebook, there's a couple of, I think it's called the International Asylum of Wrestling Collectors or something like that. Some guy actually right now is selling El Gigante loose for like $10.
Really?
Yeah, oh, selling him loose for $10. He had a Dustin Rhodes for the same price, but I believe he sold the Dustin. But yeah, check Facebook too. They have some pretty good groups on there that are selling figures at good prices.
Right on. I'll definitely check that out.
Right on.
You guys have talked about, while we're on the WCW kick, you guys kind of frequently pick on Toy Biz, and rightfully so. I'm just curious, do either of you guys have any Toy Biz figures in your collection or OSFTM figures in your collection?
We do have the OSFTMs. We had the vibrating figures that we've messed around with a little bit, but we did have those. Scott was more into the Toy Biz. I stayed away and picked up maybe one or two of them. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I do have the Brett in Pinstripe. As much as I didn't want it, KB had it marked down to like $4.99. $5.99, and I was like, oh, why not, you know?
It's a Brett figure. You gotta have it.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, Scott was more into the Toy Biz figures.
Yeah, I'm usually, when Toy Biz comes up, I'm usually the defender of the Toy Biz, because I did have most, I didn't get into the gimmick figures, but I did have most of the original line, and then all of the regular ones that came out that were not gimmick figures. So I collected, actually, most of the Toy Biz, and for the most part, I thought that they nailed a lot of those sculpts, and, I actually appreciate most of the Toy Biz figures.
Yeah,
I think the issue is that the gimmicks are so bad. And
yes.
I mean, it really a lot of times seems like there was more, this is probably wrong, but it seems like there was more of the gimmick type figures than just sticking with a basic line of figures. I mean, there's so many bad ones out there. And
yeah, I agree the only with one, you.
The only one I've ever bought, gone out of my way to buy was in 2001, we were at, there's two of them that I bought. We were at a KB at one of those outlet malls, and they had that Evolution of Sting package with the five or six figures.
Yeah, we actually just talked about that on this past week's podcast.
I haven't finished that podcast yet, so I gotta do that. But yeah, they had those for $10, and so I was like, oh, I gotta buy one of those. You can't pass that up. And that thing actually looks really cool in the package. You take the figures out, and they're not so good looking individually, but the whole packaging of it and everything is really cool. And then that same summer I was back home visiting family, and one of the KBs had that series of figures with what were they called, with the t-shirts and the tattoos?
Oh, Unleashed or something like that.
Yeah, I can't remember, but I picked up the Vampiro one.
That one's super rare. That's a good pickup.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, was Shane Douglas in that set too?
I think he might have been. I know Jeff Jarrett was for sure, and I think there was another Goldberg that they put in that one.
Yeah, the only one I bought was Vampiro, because at that point it was like, when are you going to see another Vampiro figure?
It was the only one worth getting, to be honest with you, out of that set.
Yeah, it really was. So I've got a few of those, and then we have some laying around in our bucket that we've bought lots of figures over the years, and they've shown up in there. And it's kind of funny, we went to a toy show about 3 or 4 years ago, and it was this guy and his wife, and they were the only people doing it. They didn't have like different vendors there, but he and his wife had apparently from about 1995 to about 1999 bought every toy known to man and were trying to sell them. And so there wasn't a lot of really cool stuff, but there was the BCA figures, and he was selling them dirt cheap. So my kids bought the Hardcore Hack toys. It's like a block. The thing is terrible. It's just all.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. Like, there were a few misses.
Do you guys remember in 97, I think it was, there was a line of figures, and I can't remember what they're called. They're little small guys, and they came in two packages. They came in packs of two, and like the guys are like kind of like flexing, and there was a Brett and Austin. And
were they standing on a ring?
No. It was about the same time as those. but these were like actual little figures. Now, they might have come with a little ring for each of them, but there was
I remember those. They were super small and super buff.
Yeah, yep. And I picked up the guy had those, and I've had the Brett and the Austin sitting on my desk for as long as those came out. But the guy had the Sean and Owen two-pack for like $5, and so I picked that up. I thought that was kind of cool.
Good pickup.
I remember with Toy Biz, I remember Rick Steiner had one where he came with a gargoyle, and it was like a great Rick Steiner, but the gargoyle, I'm like, really?
What? The accessories through that line.
Why is there a gargoyle with him?
Guys, it was funny. You guys were talking about Stomp a couple weeks ago, and that's another one. Those things were just terrible. The Ahmed Johnson in the overalls.
Yeah. Redneck Ahmed, what?
Yeah, the only one of those I ever bought, and I actually still have, was that Brian Pillman, because it was like the first WWF Pillman figure at the time. And really, when you stripped off all of the armor and everything or whatever, it didn't look too bad.
It was still a good Pillman figure at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Without the gimmicky stuff.
And then there was another set that came out that was basically like in scuba gear.
Yep.
Oh.
China was in that set, I think, and the Headbangers.
Yeah.
Because there was a space set, two of them or something like that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, those things were terrible.
It's like, just go back to regular bone crunching, please. Michael, another thing we like to do is have our guest also have a wish list. Is there any figures that you wish to see? I know that we buried this a while back between Scott and I, but we also like to have our guests, maybe if there's a wish list or a figure that they would like to see. Do you happen to have one?
I'd like to see a better Terry Gordy figure. Bringing that up again, he's got the Jax figure with the Freebirds and the Executioner figure and the old AWA Remco. I talked with when Figures Toy Company first announced the Legends line, and I talked with Chris about this, but Gino Hernandez and Chris Adams would be so cool.
We haven't had one for that yet. That's a good wish list.
That's a good call right there.
Yeah, I'm such a big fan of Gino. I mean, he was so unlikable and just a great heel. I mean, he was really, and both of them were really good in the ring and worked so well with the Von Erichs. And that's another one right there, I guess. A David Von Erich figure, and I like World Class quite a bit. So you know, some of the guys from that time would be maybe see Mattel take a shot at a Bruiser Brody figure. The Jax one was okay.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one.
I'd like to see Mattel put out a better one. Stan Hansen, I think, would make another cool figure. I'm always kind of going back to that period in time, and I think, like everybody, you know, a good Owen Hart figure.
Yes.
Would be really cool. My kids were looking at I've got some of my older ones in a box, and I've got the. Do you remember they put out I think they were called Best of 97. Series Jax did them at the BCAs, and there's an Owen in there that has a Hart Foundation vest.
Mm-hmm.
Yep,
I sure do.
He has the two-time Slammy Award winning tights on.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's pretty cool. But that's, you know, unfortunately, that's probably the best Owen figure out there. There's just not, you know, from that period, there's just not a lot. So that would be up there too.
I know that Chris was on Brian Breaker's podcast, and he said that they reached out to the Owen Hart family. And the Owen Hart family just seems to be really jaded by wrestling as it is right now. They just don't want to be associated with it. They were really upset with WWE, as Chris said. They were really upset with WWE by putting out that Blu-ray or that DVD.
Yeah. And it's hard to blame them. I mean, you certainly can't. But, you know, Owen's got a lot of fans, and it would be really cool to see something like that. And that, I actually just looked over here. I've got the Blue Blazer figure, too, from Jack sitting at my desk. The thing's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. That was a really good figure, too. So that wraps up our special interview with Michael Moore. Michael, before we sign off, I want to thank you for having Scott and I on your year-end top five figures awards that you had us.
Yeah.
We definitely thank you. That was awesome of you to reach out to us and, one, letting us have more than five figures.
There's two of you guys. You got 10 of them. So, yeah. I appreciate you guys doing it. You know, I really wanted to get some input from some people that really know what they're talking about. And so having you guys and Chris and Matthew Goldberg put together their list, I thought was, you know, I kind of did it in a pinch. I didn't have a lot of time to kind of brainstorm other people to do with that. But I thought you guys were the first group of you two. And like I said, Matt and Chris were the first ones that really came to mind for that. And I thought you guys did a great job, and I really appreciated your input on that.
We thank you. Thank you. Scott and I were completely honored to do it. We couldn't thank you enough for having us do it. So
yeah, absolutely.
Michael, thank you for being on. Scott, anything else?
Happy toy hunting.
Yeah, happy toy hunting. I can go out this afternoon and see what I can find. So
nice.
Hopefully you find something cool, man.
Yep.
DM me if you find anything.
Well, I will.
Michael, do you have any plugs that you want to get in?
Follow me on Twitter, mmorewriter, WRITER. You can email me, michaelmorewriter@gmail.com. I've got a torch column up, like I mentioned, on the Galoob figures. Should be out by the time this comes out. And I've got a couple of pretty fun interviews coming out, so just keep an eye out.
Great, great. So we will sign off. #FigLife. Adios.